that a single individual had so hypnotized the nation that he had driven its otherwise healthy progress off the rails. It was more than anything else the ways in which nationalism had developed in late 19th century Germany that provided the set of ideas that, if often in distorted, even perverted form, offered the potential for Nazism's post-war appeal. In particular, the years between 1909 and 1914 saw a strengthening and regrouping of the radical right that formed a bridge spanning the war to the post-war political world. Crucial to the character of German nationalism was the pervasive sense, present already long before the war, of incomplete unity, of persistent, even widening division and conflict within the nation. What, in the changed conditions after the war, Hitler was able most signally to exploit was the belief that pluralism was somehow unnatural or unhealthy in a society, that it was a sign of weakness, and that internal division and disharmony could be suppressed and eliminated to be replaced by the unity of a national community. The desire for national unity to supplant internal dissension and overcome division was a hallmark of all shadings of nationalist feeling in Imperial Germany. The very superficiality of the unity that Bismarck had constitutionally forged in 1871 and superimposed upon a highly fragmented society divided by religion, class, and region encouraged the deliberate nationalization of the masses, not least through the manufacture of a sense of nationhood which was exclusivist, ringed off against those who did not belong to it. Leading historian Heinrich von Treitschke, a prominent spokesman of a sharpened, aggressive national consciousness, an integral nationalism excluding enemies of the Reich, was one of many well-known intellectuals who helped inordinately to strengthen such ideas among the educated bourgeoisie. The Jews are our misfortune was among the influential sentiments to which Treitschke lent his weighty name. Poles and Jews, Catholics and especially social democrats, were all targeted outsiders under Bismarck. But the discrimination and repression backfired. The Kulturkampf, Bismarck's attack on Catholic education, institutions and clergy in Germany during the 1870s, substantially strengthened Catholicism, while the 12 years of the socialist law, which imposed bans on socialist associations, meetings and publications, produced a greatly enlarged social democratic party committed to a Marxist program. By the eve of the First World War, following the 1912 Reichstag election, the SPD was easily the largest party in the Reichstag, provoking alarm and deepening hatred in the upper and middle classes. By this time, the largest socialist movement in Europe, whose Marxist program sought the demolition of the existing state, stood opposed by a highly aggressive integral nationalism aiming to destroy Marxist socialism. That the German nation-state arose from the unification of a number of individual states further encouraged a sense of nationhood which had gained definition from culture and language, rather than attaching itself to and emerging from the institutions of a pre-existing unitary state, as in the case of England or France. This promoted an ethnic definition of nationhood, which could easily slide over, though it by no means always did so, into forms of racism, especially when, as was the case in Germany as elsewhere in Europe, nationalism blended into imperialism and was directed aggressively outwards as well as defensively inwards, voicing shrill demands for a colonial place in the sun. All nationalisms need their myths. In this case, a powerful one was the Reich myth. The very name of the new nation-state, German Reich, evoked for many the mystical claim to reinstate the First Reich of Frederick Barbarossa, sleeping, according to the saga, in his holy mountain beneath the Kiffhauser in Thuringia until the rebirth of his medieval Reich. The new aesthetics of nationalism called for the continuity to be symbolized in the gigantic monument to Kaiser Wilhelm I, mainly funded by veterans' associations, erected on the Kiffhauser in 1896. The Reich myth linked national unity and the ending of division to heroic deeds and individual greatness, interpreting previous German history as the prelude to the ultimate attainment of national unity. Schoolbooks glorified the exploits of a pantheon of national heroes filled with warriors reaching back to the legendary Hermann the Cherusker, the name attached to Arminius, the Germanic leader who inflicted a crushing defeat on 3 Roman legions in 9 AD. His colossal monument in the Teutoburger Wald and that of Germania on the Niederwald monument near Rüdesheim on the Rhine, which so impressed Hitler when he saw it for the first time in 1914, en route for the battlefields of Flanders, gave granite expression to the Reich myth. And once the foundation of the German Reich itself passed from current politics into history, and its architect's contentious career had been peremptorily ended by the new Kaiser, Bismarck himself became the focal point of a cult which eulogized him as the greatest hero of all, statesman and warrior combined. Hundreds of Bismarck towers, initiated by student bodies and erected the length and breadth of the country, represented the national hero as the intended symbol of nation, state, and people. And the more, after Bismarck's departure, the Reichstag, initially together with the monarchy, the embodiment of national unity, came to be seen as the barometer of national division, a house of squabbling politicians and competing parties, the more there appeared to be the need for a new Bismarck, a new national hero. A claim to such a role was initially advanced by no less than the Kaiser himself. The Caesaristic tendencies, increasingly a feature of German nationalism towards the end of the 19th century, were deliberately furthered after 1890 by the promotion of a Hohenzollern cult focused on the new and ambitious Kaiser, Wilhelm II, and intended to represent in his person the 2 images of the governing statesman and the sleeping hero Kaiser. The new Kaiser, it was implied, would lead Germany to external greatness and eliminate divisions within. Increasingly shrill voices on the nationalist right demanded nothing less. However, the gap between words and deeds was too great. Disappointment and disillusionment in the Kaiser both helped promote the Bismarck cult and led to increasingly vociferous nationalist opposition, its most radical voices demanding the extension of German power and greatness through expansion and conquest of inferior peoples. The assertiveness of German nationalism at the turn of the century was in no small measure aggression born of fear. Not just the traditional antagonism towards the French and the growing rivalry with Great Britain, but also the presumed threat seen in the Slavic East, and internally the perceived looming menace of social democracy and culturally pessimistic worries about national degeneration and decline. In a climate shaped by an often irrational fear of enemies, within and without, who allegedly threatened the future of the nation, it is not surprising that alongside extreme anti-Marxism, racial ideologies, not just anti-Semitism, but social Darwinism and eugenics, should increasingly gain currency. None was confined to Germany, of course. Social Darwinism was influential in Britain. The classic lands of racial anti-Semitism around the turn of the century were Austria-Hungary and France, the region of the most vicious physical persecution of Jews, Russia. But in the German context, the racial ideas of the populist radical right, taken over in good part by conservatives, acquired a level of backing that necessarily posed a substantial threat to individuals and minorities. The supremacy of the nation over the individual, the stress on order and authority, opposition to internationalism and equality, became increasingly pronounced features of German national feeling. With them grew demands for racial consciousness and antagonism towards the tiny Jewish minority, overwhelmingly seeking assimilation, increased. Jews could be described, as they were in a widely read text of the 1890s, as poison for us, and will have to be treated as such, and in increasingly common bacteriological language, as a pest and a cholera. Such extreme views were by no means representative. Most Jews in Imperial Germany could feel reasonably sanguine about the future, could regard anti-Semitism as a throwback to a more primitive era that was on the way out. But they underestimated both the pernicious ways in which modern racial anti-Semitism differed from archaic forms of persecution of Jews, however vicious, in its uncompromising emphasis upon biological distinctiveness, its links with assertive nationalism, and the ways it could be taken over and exploited in new types of political mass movements. And they were too ready to overlook the appeal of racist classics like Houston Stuart Chamberlain's Grundlagen des 19 Jahrhunderts, Foundations of the 19th Century, a bestseller since its appearance in 1900, and Theodor Fritsch's popularizing Catechism for Antisemites, his Handbuch der Judenfrage, Handbook of the Jewish Question, which went through 25 editions within 7 years of publication in 1887. While purely anti-Semitic parties proved too narrowly focused and were in decline in the late imperial era, racial anti-Semitism had by then been increasingly taken over by parties, associations, pressure groups, student unions, and interest organizations, and intermingled with the rest of the package of anti-Marxist, imperialist, militaristic, radical nationalism. The eugenics movement, originating in England and finding followers in Scandinavia and America, but gaining new levels of support in Germany, fomented the fears, bordering on paranoia, of racial degeneration resulting from a declining birth rate among the better social groups and a rise in the proportion of inferiors within the population. There was also growing resentment at the cost of supporting those seen as a burden on society, the worthless lives of antisocials, the handicapped, inferiors, and especially the mentally sick, whose alleged uninhibited sexual drive was regarded as a further stimulus to racial degeneration. It was in this context that the idea of sterilizing certain categories of degenerates, an idea already described by one doctor in 1889 as a sacred duty of the state, found growing support in medical circles. Above all, national assertiveness derived from the sense of greatness attained through conquest and based on cultural superiority, the feeling that Germany was a great and expanding power, and that a great power needed and deserved an empire. Germany had been late on the act in the imperialist carve-up in Africa. The bits and pieces of territory it had acquired in the 1880s could by no means match its pretensions, least of all satisfy the growing clamour on the right that the rapid growth of population had left Germany a people without space. The demand for colonial and commercial empire, built into the slogan of Weltpolitik, was, in essence, little different to the claims of British and French imperialists. But alongside Weltpolitik grew ideas of territorial expansion into Eastern Europe at the expense of Slav Untermenschen, ideas voiced ever more shrilly by some of the most important nationalist pressure groups and increasingly entering the ideology of the German Conservative Party. These pressure groups, crucial to the dissemination of nationalist, imperialist, and racist ideas of all varieties, offered new possibilities of propaganda, agitation, and extra-parliamentary opposition. The largest, the Navy League, founded in 1898 to push for the building of a large battle fleet, had over 1 million members and associates by 1914. The propaganda output, newspapers, pamphlets, even films, of such organizations was massive. While the Navy League could be said to have been mainstream in its nationalist message, the Eastern Marches Association, Ostmarkenverein, and especially the Pan-German League, were, if smaller, more radical and more racist. The former advocated harsh measures of legal discrimination in a racial struggle against the Poles in the Prussian border provinces. The Pan-Germans, influential beyond their numbers and with a high leaven of teachers and academics in their ranks, were the most radical of all in their ideology built up of folkish nationalism and racist imperialism, embedded in a Manichaean worldview of a struggle between good and evil, ideas which anticipated a good part of the Nazi worldview, and an organization, though small, that formed a link to the huge Fatherland Party of 1917 and the post-war radical right. The leader of the Pan-German League, Heinrich Klass, writing in 1912 under the pseudonym of Daniel Freimann, advocated in his polemical tract, Wenn ich der Kaiser wäre, if I were the Kaiser, franchise restrictions, press censorship, repressive laws against socialism, and anti-Jewish legislation as the basis of national renewal. Not least, given the widespread profound disappointment in the Kaiser, he demanded a strong, able leader, whom all who have remained unseduced by the teachings of Ungermann democracy yearn for, because they know that greatness can only be brought about through the concentration of individual forces, which again can only be achieved by the subordination to a leader. By the time the war began, Klass's book had gone through 5 editions, an indication that the ideas of the new right, though still a minority, were falling increasingly on fertile ground in the years before Germany became enveloped in the European conflagration. This shift on the nationalist right, already before the war, is important for an understanding of the radicalization that took place during the war itself and the links with the rapid spread of folkish politics immediately thereafter. On the eve of the First World War, Germany was certainly a state with some unattractive features, among them those of the unbalanced character sitting on the imperial throne. But nothing in its development predetermined the path to the Third Reich. What happened under Hitler was not presaged in Imperial Germany. It is unimaginable without the experience of the First World War and what followed it. 2. Looking back, just over a decade later, Hitler spoke of the 15 months he spent in Munich before the war as the happiest and by far the most contented of his life. The fanatical German nationalist exulted in his arrival in a German city, which he contrasted with the Babylon of races that for him had been Vienna. He gave a number of reasons why he had left Vienna: bitter enmity towards the Habsburg Empire for pro-Slav policies that were disadvantaging the German population, growing hatred for the foreign mixture of peoples who were corroding German culture in Vienna, the conviction that Austria-Hungary was living on borrowed time and that its end could not come soon enough, and the intensified longing to go to Germany, to where his childhood's secret desires and secret love had drawn him. The last sentiments were plainly romanticized. Otherwise the feelings were genuine enough, and of his determination not to fight for the Habsburg state there can be no doubt. This is what Hitler meant when he said he left Austria primarily for political reasons. But the implication that he had left as a form of political protest was disingenuous and deliberately misleading. As we have already noted, the prime and immediate reason he crossed the border into Germany was very tangible. The Linz authorities were hot on his trail for evasion of military service. The city to which Hitler became more attached than to any other spot of earth in this world was, in the years before the First World War, alongside Paris, Vienna, and Berlin, one of Europe's most vibrant cultural capitals, a hotbed of creativity and artistic innovation. Schwabing, the pulsating center of Munich's artistic and bohemian life, drew artists, painters, and writers from all over Germany and from other parts of Europe as well. They turned Schwabing's cafes, pubs, and cabarets into experimental hothouses of the modern. In no city in Germany did old and new clash so forcefully as in Munich, commented Lovis Corinth, one celebrated artist who experienced the atmosphere there at the turn of the century. The theme of decline and renewal, the casting off of the sterile, decaying order, contempt for bourgeois convention, for the old, the stale, the traditional, the search for new expression and aesthetic values, the evocation of feeling over reason, the glorification of youth and exuberance, linked many of the disparate strands of Munich's modernist cultural scene. The Stefan George circle, the scourge of bourgeois morality, playwright and cabaret balladist Franz Wedekind, the great lyric poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and the Mann brothers, Thomas, famous since the publication in 1901 of his epic novel of bourgeois decline, Buddenbrooks, and whose vignette of bourgeois decay, Der Tod in Venedig, Death in Venice, had been published the year that Hitler arrived, and his elder, more politically radical brother Heinrich, were but some among the galaxy of literary luminaries in pre-war Munich. In painting, too, the challenge of the modern characterized the era. Around the very time that Hitler was in Munich, Vasily Kandinsky, Franz Marc, Paul Klee, Alexei von Jawlensky, Gabriele Münter, and August Macher were leading lights in the group Der Blaue Reiter, revolutionizing artistic composition in brilliant and exciting new forms of expressionist painting. The visual arts would never be the same again. It was not for political reasons, but as a metropolis of German art, that Munich attracted the dropout, failed artist, and street-scene painter Adolf Hitler. Once again, as a few years earlier, he made his way to an epicenter of the modernist cultural revolution. But in Munich, as in Vienna, the avant-garde passed him by. His cultural taste remained locked in the 19th century, closed to modern art forms, hostile to the works of all those for whom Munich before the First World War is renowned. What impressed him, as they had done in Vienna, were the imposing representative buildings, the neoclassical facades, the wide boulevards, the great galleries of works of the old masters, the architecture of grandeur and power. It was the city of the Wittelsbachs, not the city of artistic innovation that appealed to Hitler. He rhapsodized about the Pinakothek, a most marvelous achievement attributable to one man alone. What Munich owes to Ludwig I is unimaginable. The Glyptothek and Propyläen on the Königsplatz, later the scene of the Nazi commemoration each year of the heroes of the movement who had been killed in the Putsch fiasco of 1923. The Wittelsbach residence and the expansive Ludwigstrasse, flanked by its monumental facades, were other constructions of that era that stirred the impressionistic Hitler. He later saw similarities in the representative buildings of 19th century Munich to those of Berlin in the time of Frederick the Great. In both cases, they had been erected cheaply since funding was so limited. His own plans for a gigantic rebuilding of Munich after a second war were not intended to encounter similar difficulties. The massive bill would have been paid by the conquered peoples of Europe. Hitler wrote that he came to Munich in the hope of someday making a name for himself as an architect. He described himself on arrival as an architectural painter. In the letter he wrote to the Linz authorities in 1914, defending himself against charges of evading military service, he stated that he was forced to earn his living as a self-employed artist, Kunstmaler, in order to fund his training as an architectural painter, Architekturmaler. In the biographical sketch he wrote in 1921, he stated that he went to Munich as an architecture designer and architecture painter. At his trial, 3 years later, in February 1924, he implied that he had already completed his training as an architecture designer, Architekturzeichner, by the time he came to Munich, but wanted to train to be a master builder. Many years later, he claimed his intention was to undertake practical training in Germany, that on coming to Munich he had hoped to study for 3 years before joining the major Munich construction firm Heilmann and Littmann as a designer, and then showing, by entering the first architectural competition, to design an important building just what he could do. None of these varying and conflicting accounts was true. There is no evidence that Hitler took any practical steps during his time in Munich to improve his poor and dwindling career prospects. He was drifting no less aimlessly than he had done in Vienna. After arriving in Munich on the 25th of May, 1913, a bright spring Sunday, Hitler followed up an advertisement for a small room rented by the family of the tailor Josef Popp on the third floor of 34 Schleißheimerstraße in a poorish district to the north of the city, on the edge of Schwabing and not far from the big barracks area. His travelling companion, Rudolf Hausler, shared the cramped room with him until mid-February 1914. Apparently Hitler's habit of reading late at night by the light of a petroleum lamp prevented Hausler from sleeping and so irritated him that he eventually moved out, returning after a few days to take the room adjacent to Hitler's, where he stayed until May 1914. According to his landlady, Frau Popp, Hitler quickly set himself up with the equipment to begin painting. As he had done in Vienna, he developed a routine where he could complete a picture every 2 or 3 days, usually copied from postcards of well-known tourist scenes in Munich, including the Theater in der Kirche, the Assamkirche, the Hofbrauhaus, the Alte Hof, the Münzhof, the Altes Rathaus, the Sendlinger Tor, the Residenz, the Propyläen, then set out to find customers in bars, cafes, and beer halls. His accurate but uninspired, rather soulless watercolours were, as Hitler himself later admitted when he was German Chancellor and they were selling for massively inflated prices, of very ordinary quality. But they were certainly no worse than similar products touted about the beer halls, often the work of genuine art students seeking to pay their way. Once he had found his feet, Hitler had no difficulty finding buyers. He was able to make a modest living from his painting and exist about as comfortably as he had done in his last years in Vienna. When the Linz authorities caught up with him in 1914, he acknowledged that his income, though irregular and fluctuating, could be put at around 1,200 marks a year, and told his court photographer, Heinrich Hoffmann, at a much later date, that he could get by on around 80 marks a month for living costs at that time. As in Vienna, Hitler was polite, but distant, self-contained, withdrawn, and apparently without friends, other than in the first months, Hausler. Frau Popp could not recall Hitler having a single visitor in the entire 2 years of his tenancy. He lived simply and frugally, preparing his paintings during the day and reading at night. According to Hitler's own account, the study of the political events of the day, especially foreign policy, preoccupied him during his time in Munich. He also claimed to have immersed himself again in the theoretical literature of Marxism and to have examined thoroughly once more the relation of Marxism to the Jews. There is no obvious reason to doubt his landlady's witness to the books he brought back with him from the Bayerische Staatsbibliothek, not far away in Ludwigstrasse. In all the millions of recorded words of Hitler, however, there is nothing to indicate that he ever pored over the theoretical writings of Marxism, that he had studied Marx or Engels or Lenin, who had been in Munich not long before him, or Trotsky, his contemporary in Vienna. Reading for Hitler, in Munich as in Vienna, was not for enlightenment or learning, but to confirm prejudice. Most of it was probably done in cafes, where Hitler could continue his habit of devouring the newspapers available to customers. All of humankind, and the whole gamut of views on politics and society, God and the universe, were represented at this time in Munich's cafes, pubs, and beer halls. In well-known venues like Café Stephanie, in Amalienstrasse, left-wing intellectuals, some of whom would several years later be involved in the revolutionary upheavals, and Schwabing's artists and writers voiced their biting social and political critique, designing innumerable variants of the coming utopia. Hitler's scene was less high-flying. His milieu was that of the beer-table philosophers and corner-café improvers of the world, the cranks and half-educated know-alls. This is where he kept abreast of political developments, and where, at the slightest provocation, he could flare up and treat anyone in proximity to his fiercely held views on whatever preoccupied him at the time. Café and beer hall discussions were the nearest Hitler came in his Munich period to political involvement. His statement in Mein Kampf that in the years 1913 and 1914, I, for the first time in various circles, which today in part faithfully support the National Socialist movement, expressed the conviction that the question of the future of the German nation was the question of destroying Marxism, elevates coffeehouse confrontation into the philosophy of the political prophet. Hitler's captive audiences in the cafes and beer halls were, for most part, the closest he came to human contact in his months in Munich, and presumably offered some sort of outlet for his pent-up prejudice and emotions. It is likely, as an Austrian who despised the Habsburg monarchy and had arrived starry-eyed in Germany, that, as his account in Mein Kampf suggests, he was much exercised by the approving views on the German-Austrian alliance that he was hearing in Bavaria, and could neither comprehend nor tolerate. But most of his reflections on foreign policy in the chapter dealing with his time in Munich plainly post-date his pre-war stay in the city and present his position in 1924. Contrary to his own depiction of the Munich months as a time of further preparation for what fate would eventually bring him, it was in reality an empty, lonely, and futile period for him. He was in love with Munich, but Munich was not in love with him. He did not belong in the avant-garde café culture of Schwabing and the smart set of Munich's artists and literati. He was not in tune with white-blue Bavarian provincialism, the dominance of political Catholicism, and the strength of anti-Prussian feeling that ran from the ruddy-faced vegetable sellers on the Viktualienmarkt to the sophisticated lampooners of the Kaiser in the satirical magazine Simplicissimus. He was left to his own form of the Munich bohème, loitering in cafes, browsing in newspapers and periodicals, and waiting for the chance to harangue those around him on the error of their political ways. As regards his own future, he had no more idea where he was going than he had done during his years in the Vienna men's home. He very nearly ended up in an Austrian prison. Already in August 1913, the Linz police had started inquiries about Hitler's whereabouts because of his failure to register for military service. Evasion of military service was punishable by a hefty fine, and leaving Austria to avoid it was treated as desertion and carried a jail sentence. By way of his relatives in Linz, the Viennese police and the men's home in Meldenmannstrasse, the trail eventually led to Munich, where the police were able to inform their Linz counterparts that Hitler had been registered since the 26th of May 1913 as living with the Pops at 34 Schleißheimerstrasse. Hitler was shaken to the core when an officer of the Munich criminal police turned up on Frau Pupp's doorstep on the afternoon of Sunday, the 18th of January, 1914, with a summons for him to appear 2 days later in Linz under pain of fine and imprisonment to register for military service, and promptly took him under arrest prior to handing him over to the Austrian authorities. The Munich police had for some reason delayed delivery of the summons for several days before the Sunday, leaving Hitler as a consequence extremely short notice to comply with its demand to be in Linz by the Tuesday. That, together with Hitler's rundown appearance, lack of ready money, apologetic demeanour, and somewhat pathetic explanation, influenced the Austrian consulate in Munich to look with some sympathy on his position. Hitler's request by telegram on Monday, the 19th of January, to delay the summons to the subsequent mustering in Linz on the 5th of February was rejected by the Linz magistracy. But the telegram from Linz arrived in Munich only much later that day after the consulate was closed. The consulate handled it the following morning with customary bureaucratic sluggishness, so that Hitler received it only at 9 a.m. on Wednesday, the 21st of January, the day after he had been due to appear in Linz. Luck was again on Hitler's side. But he was left in no doubt about the seriousness of the situation. In some agitation, he now wrote a 3.5-page letter, humbly accepting his fault in failing to register in autumn 1909, at a very bitter time for him when he had hit rock bottom, but claiming he had done so retrospectively in February 1910 and heard nothing thereafter, even though he had been registered throughout with the police in Vienna. He impressed the consular officials, who thought him worthy of consideration, and the Linz magistracy now granted him permission to appear, as he had requested, on the 5th of February in Salzburg instead of Linz. No fine or imprisonment was imposed. His travel expenses were paid by the consulate, and in the event on duly attending at Salzburg, he was found to be too weak to undertake military service. Hitler had escaped with shock and embarrassment, but little else, from the difficulties he had created for himself. He still had to cope at a later date with the capital his political enemies would draw from the affair, and his frantic efforts to recover the files immediately after the Anschluss were doomed to failure. Before the Gestapo could get its hands on them, they had already been removed into safekeeping, from which they could be retrieved for publication in the 1950s. Hitler returned to his mundane life as a small-time artist, but not for long. The storm clouds were gathering over Europe. Hitler described in a rare and apposite lyrical passage of Mein Kampf an atmosphere that lay on the chests of men like a heavy nightmare, sultry as feverish tropic heat. He spoke of constant anxiety and the sense of approaching catastrophe, turning into a longing for action, for the cleansing and freshness that the storm brings. His first reaction on hearing, on Sunday the 28th of June 1914, the sensational news of the assassination in Sarajevo of the heir to the Austrian throne, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and his wife, was to fear that it had been perpetrated by German students. Given Franz Ferdinand's support for pro-Slav policies, this was a not unreasonable assumption and a more likely eventuality than his murder at the hands of Serbian nationalists. Hitler's relief at the identity of the perpetrators mingled with his sense that a stone had been set rolling whose course could no longer be arrested, that at last war would be inevitable. By the beginning of August, the countries of Europe, as Lloyd George put it, had indeed slithered over the brink into the boiling cauldron. The continent was at war. 3. For Hitler, the war was a godsend. Since his failure in the Art Academy in 1907, he had vegetated, resigned to the fact that he would not become a great artist, now cherishing a pipe dream that he would somehow become a notable architect, though with no plans for or realistic hope of fulfilling this ambition. 7 years after that failure, the nobody of Vienna, now in Munich, remained a dropout and nonentity, futilely angry at a world which had rejected him. He was still without any career prospects, without qualifications, or any expectation of gaining them, without any capacity for forging close and lasting friendships, and without real hope of coming to terms with himself, or with a society he despised for his own failure. The war offered him his way out. At the age of 25, it gave him, for the first time in his life, a cause, a commitment, comradeship, an external discipline, a sort of regular employment, a sense of well-being, and, more than that, a sense of belonging. His regiment became home for him. When he was wounded in 1916, his first words to his superior officer were, "It's not so bad, Herr Oberleutnant, eh? I can stay with you, stay with the regiment." Later in the war, the prospect of leaving the regiment may well have influenced his wish not to be considered for promotion. And at the end of the war, he had good practical reasons for staying in the army as long as possible. The army had by then been his career for 4 years, and he had no other job to go back to or look forward to. For the first time in his life, certainly the first time since the carefree childhood days as a mummy's boy in Upper Austria, Hitler felt truly at ease with himself in the war. He referred later to the war years as the greatest and most unforgettable time of my earthly existence. Later still, in the midst of a second war that he himself had done more than any other single person to unleash on Germany, Europe, and the world, he reminisced incessantly and always in glowing terms about his experiences in the First World War. His years in the army were the one time, he commented on one occasion, when I had no worries. Food, clothing, and accommodation were all provided. He had been, he said, passionately glad to be a soldier. The war and its aftermath made Hitler. After Vienna, it was the second formative period in decisively shaping his personality. Germany, like other countries in Europe, had been gripped by war fever in the wake of Franz Ferdinand's assassination. On the very evening of the assassination, a riotous crowd in Munich had smashed up the well-known Café Farig in the city centre, because the band entertaining the customers had refused to play Germany's stirringly patriotic unofficial anthem, Die Wacht am Rhein. A few weeks later, an angry mob in the same part of the city set upon two women overheard speaking French, who, faces bleeding and with torn clothes, had to be rescued by the police. The spirit of 1914 was more varied in expression than often presumed, and despite such outrages, in general probably more defensive than outrightly aggressive in tone. But no sector of society was immune from the heady atmosphere of patriotic fervor. Even social democrat internationalists and left-wing liberals could not escape it, though their defensive patriotism, weak though it was as a bulwark against belligerent chauvinism, was markedly different from the aggression and bellicosity of nationalist circles where war euphoria was unrestrained. Among middle-class youth, and especially in student groups, enthusiasm for war was often linked to an optimism that it would bring final release from the shackles of a decadent and sterile bourgeois order. "We want to glorify war, the only cure for the world," the Italian futurist manifesto had proclaimed only a few years earlier. The sentiment struck a chord with many, though certainly not all, of the younger generation across Europe in July and August 1914. Among Germany's leaders, as among ruling groups elsewhere in Europe, there was a feeling that armed conflict was necessary and salutary as a liberation from the prolonged tension and repeated crises of previous years. Strangest of all for subsequent generations to grasp, there was, most prominent among intellectuals, a sense of war as an almost religious experience, as redemption and renewal, as a welling up of sublime national unity to overcome discord and disharmony, as the creative force of a national community. What we are now, with deepest emotion, experiencing, ran the florid outpouring of a leading journal on social policy, is a resurrection, a rebirth of the nation. Suddenly shocked out of the troubles and pleasures of everyday life, Germany stands united in the strength of moral duty, ready for the highest sacrifice. The Kaiser, today truly a people's Kaiser, proclaimed, "I know no parties any longer, I know only Germans." And the Reichstag, unanimous and united, a true herald of the nation, swore by its deeds to go with the Kaiser, through thick and thin, through suffering and death. These first days of August are undying, incomparable days of glory. Whatever had arisen over four decades of peace by way of strife and discord of parties, confessions, classes, and races, has been totally consumed by the breath of flame of national fervor. Many prepared to fight with a heavy heart and from a sense of duty. Others could hardly wait for action. Hitler was among the tens of thousands in Munich, in the thrall of emotional delirium, passionately enthused by the prospect of war. As for so many others, his elation would later turn to deep embitterment. With Hitler, the emotional pendulum set moving by the onset of war swung more violently than for most. "Overpowered by stormy enthusiasm," he wrote, "I fell down on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart for granting me the good fortune of being permitted to live at this time." That on this occasion his words were true cannot be doubted. Years later, noticing a photograph taken by Heinrich Hoffmann, who was to become his court photographer, of the huge patriotic demonstration in front of the Feldherrenhalle on Munich's Odeonsplatz on the 2nd of August 1914, the day after the German declaration of war on Russia, Hitler pointed out that he had been among the emotional crowd that day, carried away with nationalist fervor, hoarse with singing Die Wacht am Rhein and Deutschland über alles. Hoffmann immediately set to work on enlargements and discovered the face of the 25-year-old Hitler in the center of the photograph, gripped and enraptured by the war hysteria. The subsequent mass reproduction of the photograph helped contribute to the establishment of the Führer myth and to Hoffmann's immense profits. It was doubtless under the impact of the same elation swaying tens of thousands of young men in Munich and many other cities in Europe during those days to rush to join up that, according to his own account, on the 3rd of August, the day following the mass demonstration at the Feldherrenhalle, Hitler submitted his request, a personal petition to King Ludwig III of Bavaria, to serve as an Austrian in the Bavarian army. The granting of his request by the Cabinet Office, he went on, arrived, to his unbounded joy, the very next day. Though this version has been accepted in most accounts, it is scarcely credible. In the confusion of those days, it would have required truly remarkable bureaucratic efficiency for Hitler's request to have been approved overnight. In any case, not the Cabinet Office, but the War Ministry was alone empowered to accept foreigners, including Austrians, as volunteers. In reality, Hitler owed his service in the Bavarian army not to bureaucratic efficiency, but to bureaucratic oversight. Detailed inquiries carried out by the Bavarian authorities in 1924 were unable to clarify precisely how, instead of being returned to Austria in August 1914, as should have happened, he came to serve in the Bavarian army. It was presumed that he was among the flood of volunteers who rushed to their nearest place of recruitment in the first days of August, leading, the report added, to not unnatural inconsistencies and breaches of the strict letter of the law. In all probability, commented the report, the question of Hitler's nationality, Staatsangehörigkeit, was never even raised. Hitler, it was concluded, almost certainly entered the Bavarian army by error. Probably, as Hitler wrote in a brief autobiographical sketch in 1921, he volunteered on the 5th of August 1914 for service in the 1st Bavarian Infantry Regiment. Like many others in these first chaotic days, he was initially sent away again, since there was no immediate use for him. On the 16th of August, he was summoned to report at Recruiting Depot 6 in Munich for kitting out by the 2nd Reserve Battalion of the 2nd Infantry Regiment. By the beginning of September, he had been assigned to the newly formed Bavarian Reserve Infantry Regiment 16, known from the name of its first commander as the List Regiment, largely comprising raw recruits. Together with his fellow soldiers, he then underwent a period of training and drilling in Munich, followed by exercises at Lechfeld, near Augsburg, that lasted until the 20th of October. On that day, Hitler dropped a note to the Pops, telling them his unit was about to leave for the front, probably Belgium, how much he was looking forward to it, and that he hoped they would get to England. In the early hours of the next morning, the troop train carrying Hitler left for the battlefields of Flanders. On the 29th of October, within 6 days of arriving in Lille, Hitler's battalion had its baptism of fire on the Menin Road near Ypres. In letters from the front to Josef Popp and to a Munich acquaintance, Ernest Hepp, Hitler wrote that after 4 days of fighting, the List Regiment's fighting force had been reduced from 3,600 to 611 men. The initial losses have indeed been estimated at around 70%, partly even incurred through friendly fire, as Württemberg and Saxon regiments mistook the Bavarians in the gloom for English soldiers. Colonel List himself was among the fallen. Hitler's initial idealism, he said later, gave way on seeing the thousands killed and injured to the realization that life is a constant, horrible struggle. On the 3rd of November 1914, with effect from the 1st of November, Hitler was promoted to corporal. It was his last promotion of the war, though he could certainly have been expected to advance further, at least as far as non-commissioned officer, Unteroffizier. Later in the war, he was in fact nominated for promotion by Max Ammann, then a staff sergeant, subsequently Hitler's press baron, and the regimental staff considered making him Unteroffizier. Fritz Wiedemann, the regimental adjutant who in the 1930s became for a time one of the Führer's adjutants, testified after the end of the Third Reich that Hitler's superiors had thought him lacking in leadership qualities. However, both Ammann and Wiedemann made clear that Hitler, probably because he would have been then transferred from the regimental staff, actually refused to be considered for promotion. Hitler had been assigned on the 9th of November to the regimental staff as an orderly, Ordnanz, one of a group of 8 to 10 dispatch runners, Mädelgänge, whose task was to carry orders on foot or sometimes by bicycle from the regimental command post to the battalion and company leaders at the front, 3 kilometers away. Strikingly, in his Mein Kampf account, Hitler omitted to mention that he was a dispatch runner, implying that he actually spent the war in the trenches. But the attempts of his political enemies in the early 1930s to belittle the dangers involved in the duties of the dispatch runner and decry Hitler's war service, accusing him of shirking and cowardice, were misplaced. When, as was not uncommon, the front was relatively quiet, there were certainly times when the dispatch runners could laze around at staff headquarters, where conditions were greatly better than in the trenches. It was in such conditions, at regimental headquarters in Fourne, near Fromelles in the Ypres region of Flanders, where Hitler spent nearly half of his wartime service, that he could find the time to paint pictures and read, if his own account can be believed, the works of Schopenhauer that he claimed he carried around with him. Even so, the dangers faced by the dispatch runners during battles, carrying messages to the front through the firing line, were real enough. The losses among dispatch runners were relatively high. If at all possible, 2 runners would be sent with a message to ensure that it would get through if one happened to be killed. 3 of the 8 runners attached to the regimental staff were killed, and another 1 wounded in a confrontation with French troops on the 15th of November. Hitler himself, not for the only time in his life, had luck on his side 2 days later when a French shell exploded in the regimental forward command post minutes after he had gone out, leaving almost the entire staff there dead or wounded. Among the seriously wounded was the regimental commander, Oberstleutnant Philipp Engelhardt, who had been about to propose Hitler for the Iron Cross for his part, assisted by a colleague, in protecting the commander's life under fire a few days earlier. On the 2nd of December, Hitler was finally presented with the Iron Cross, second class, one of four dispatch runners among the 60 men from his regiment to receive the honor. It was, he said, the happiest day of my life. From all indications, Hitler was a committed, rather than simply conscientious and dutiful soldier, and did not lack physical courage. His superiors held him in high regard. His immediate comrades, mainly the group of dispatch runners, respected him, and it seems even quite liked him, though he could also plainly irritate as well as puzzle them. His lack of a sense of fun made him an easy target for good-natured ribbing. "What about looking around for a mamselle?" suggested a telephonist one day. "I'd die of shame, looking for sex with a French girl," interjected Hitler, to a burst of laughter from the others. "Look at the monk," one said. Hitler's retort was, "Have you no German sense of honour left at all?" Though his quirkiness singled him out from the rest of his group, Hitler's relations with his immediate comrades were generally good. Most of them later became members of the NSDAP, and when, as usually happened, they reminded Reich Chancellor Hitler of the time that they had been his comrades in arms, he made sure they were catered for with cash donations and positions as minor functionaries. For all that they got on well with him, they thought Adi, as they called him, was distinctly odd. They referred to him as the artist and were struck by the fact that he received no mail or parcels, even at Christmas, after about mid-1915, never spoke of family or friends, neither smoked nor drank, showed no interest in visits to brothels, and used to sit for hours in a corner of the dugout, brooding or reading. Photographs of him during the war show a thin, gaunt face, dominated by a thick, dark, bushy moustache. He was usually on the edge of his group, expressionless where others were smiling. One of his closest comrades, Balthasar Brandmeier, a stonemason from Bruckmühl in the Bad Aibling district of Upper Bavaria, later described his first impressions of Hitler at the end of May 1915. Almost skeletal in appearance, dark eyes, hooded in a sallow complexion, untrimmed moustache, sitting in a corner buried in a newspaper, occasionally taking a sip of tea, seldom joining in the banter of the group. He seemed an oddity, shaking his head disapprovingly at silly, light-hearted remarks, not even joining in the usual soldiers' moans, gripes, and jibes. "Haven't you ever loved a girl?" Brandmeier asked Hitler. "Look," Brandmeier was the straight-faced reply, "I've never had time for anything like that, and I'll never get round to it." His only real affection seems to have been for his dog, Foxel, a white terrier that had strayed across from enemy lines. Hitler taught it tricks, revelling in how attached it was to him and how glad it was to see him when he returned from duty. He was distraught late in the war when his unit had to move on and Foxel could not be found. "The swine who took him from me doesn't know what he did to me," was his comment many years later. He felt as strongly about none of the thousands of humans he saw slaughtered about him. The emptiness and coldness that Hitler showed throughout his life in his dealings with human beings were absent in the feeling he had for his dog. In the Führer headquarters during the Second World War, his Alsatian, Blondie, would again offer him the nearest thing he could find to friendship. But with his dogs, as with every human being he came into contact with, any relationship was based upon subordination to his mastery. "I liked Foxel so much," he recalled. "He only obeyed me." About the war itself, Hitler was utterly fanatical. No humanitarian feelings could be allowed to interfere with the ruthless prosecution of German interests. He vehemently disapproved of the spontaneous gestures of friendship at Christmas 1914, when German and British troops met in no man's land, shaking hands and singing carols together. "There should be no question of something like that during war," he protested. His comrades knew that they could always provoke Hitler with defeatist comments, real or contrived. All they had to do was to claim the war would be lost and Hitler would go off at the deep end. "For us the war can't be lost. were invariably his last words. The lengthy letter he sent on the 5th of February 1915 to his Munich acquaintance, Assessor Ernst Hepp, concluded with an insight, written in typical Hitler prose style, into his view of the war redolent of the prejudices that had been consuming him since his Vienna days. "I think so often of Munich, and each of us has only one wish, that it may soon come to the final reckoning with the gang, to the showdown, der Aufgehen, cost what it will, and that those of us who have the fortune to see their homeland again will find it purer and cleansed of alien influence, Fremdländerei, that through the sacrifices and suffering that so many hundred thousand of us make daily, that through the stream of blood that flows here day for day against an international world of enemies, not only will Germany's external enemies be smashed, but that our inner internationalism will also be broken. That would be worth more to me than all territorial gains. As far as Austria is concerned, things will happen, as I always said." Hitler evidently carried such deep-seated sentiments throughout the war. But this political outburst, tagged on to a long description of military events and wartime conditions, was unusual. He appears to have spoken little to his comrades on political matters. Perhaps the fact that his comrades thought him peculiar hindered him from giving voice to his strong opinions. "I was a soldier then, and I didn't want to talk about politics," he himself stated, though in direct contradiction he added that he often expressed his views on social democracy to his closer comrades. During his interrogation in Nuremberg in 1947, Max Ammann was adamant that Hitler had not harangued his comrades on politics during the war. He appears, too, to have scarcely mentioned the Jews. Several former comrades claimed after 1945 that Hitler had at most made a few offhand, though commonplace, comments about the Jews in those years, but that they had no inkling then of the unbounded hatred that was so visible after 1918. Balthasar Brandmeier recalled, on the other hand, in his reminiscences, first published in 1932, that during the war he had often not understood Adolf Hitler when he called the Jew the wire-puller behind all misfortune. According to Brandmeier, Hitler became more politically involved in the latter years of the war and made no secret of his feelings on what he saw as the social democrat instigators of growing unrest in Germany. Such comments, like all sources that postdate Hitler's rise to prominence and, as in this case, glorify the prescience of the future leader, have to be treated with caution. But it is difficult to dismiss them out of hand. It indeed does seem very likely, as his own account in Mein Kampf claims, that Hitler's political prejudices sharpened in the latter part of the war, during and after his first period of leave in Germany in 1916. Between March 1915 and September 1916, the List regiment fought in the trenches near Fromelles, defending a 2 kilometer stretch of the stalemated front. Heavy battles with the British were fought in May 1915 and July 1916, but in 1.5 years the front barely moved a few metres. On the 27th of September 1916, 2 months after heavy fighting in the Second Battle of Fromelles, when a British offensive was staved off with difficulty, the regiment moved southwards from Flanders and by the 2nd of October was engaged on the Somme. Within days, Hitler was wounded in the left thigh when a shell exploded in the dispatch runner's dugout, killing and wounding several of them. After treatment in a field hospital, he spent almost 2 months from the 9th of October until the 1st of December 1916 in the Red Cross Hospital at Bielitz near Berlin. He had not been in Germany for 2 years. He soon noticed how different the mood was from the heady days of August 1914. He was appalled to hear men in the hospital bragging about their malingering or how they had managed to inflict minor injuries on themselves to make sure they could escape from the front. He encountered much the same low morale and widespread discontent in Berlin during the period of his recuperation. It was his first time in the city and allowed him to pay a visit to the Nationalgalerie. But Munich shocked him most of all. He scarcely recognized the city. Anger, discontent, cursing, wherever you went. Morale was poor, people were dispirited, conditions were miserable, and as was traditional in Bavaria, the blame was placed on the Prussians. Hitler himself, according to his own account written about 8 years later, recognized in all this only the work of the Jews. He was struck too, so he said, by the number of Jews in clerical positions. Nearly every clerk was a Jew, and nearly every Jew was a clerk, compared with how few of them were serving at the front. In fact, this was a base